Have you ever thought about how a company, protects its name? I mean, it's really their identity, right? Especially when another business pops up and their name sounds a little too familiar.
Yeah, like almost stepping on their toes.
Exactly. Today, we're diving deep, and I mean deep, into a legal battle that really highlights this. It's the case of Freeling Enterprises v. International Select Group. You can almost think of this as like a masterclass in trademark protection, showing just how complicated things get when you have these overlapping brand names.
It gets messy.
It really does. This particular case, it was decided back in 1999 by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and it boils down to one key question. Is there a real chance consumers might get confused?
You hit the nail on the head. That's the core of trademark law, isn't it? The Lanham Act, it's our guiding document, our rule book for trademarks in the U.S. It's all about stopping unfair competition, but even more importantly, protecting consumers from being tricked or misled.
Yeah, it's about keeping things fair.
Exactly. And this case, this Freeling case, it's a textbook example of how courts try to balance the rights of businesses that have been around for a while with the freedom of new businesses to, jump into the market.
It's a tough balance.
Absolutely.
All right, let's set the scene here. We have Freeling Enterprises. They've been around since 1975, known for their, well, let's call it what it is, their high-end luxury decorative furniture. They sell this furniture under the name Ogetti. And this isn't some random name they came up with. It's officially registered, federally registered trademark. And here's the kicker. Since 1985, it's been deemed incontestable.
Wow, that's significant.
It sounds like they have some pretty strong legal protection around that name.
Oh, absolutely. Federal registration, that's a big deal in itself, but incontestability, that's a whole other level. You get that after 5 years of being registered. If everything's in order, all the rules are followed, and it makes your trademark, well, practically untouchable.
Untouchable how?
Like, legally speaking, your right to use that name, it's pretty much set in stone. Nobody can come along and say, oh, but that name is just describing the product, or someone else used it before you. It creates this strong legal assumption that the mark is yours and yours alone to use for those specific goods. It's a big win.
So Freeling, they're sitting pretty with Ogetti, and then in 1989, along comes International Select Group, ISG for short.
Oh.
And they start using the name Bell Ogetti for their furniture. Now, we should clarify, it's not the exact same type of furniture. ISG was more on the, let's say, budget-friendly side, ready to assemble pieces, a lot of it designed to hold electronics.
Different target market, it seems.
Right, different vibe. But when Freeling got wind of this Bell Ogetti thing, you can imagine they weren't exactly doing cartwheels. So they did what any company in their position would do. They slapped ISG with a lawsuit for trademark infringement. And here's where it gets interesting. The first court to hear this, the district court, they actually sided with ISG. Yeah, they basically said, look, consumers aren't likely to get Ogetti mixed up with Bellogetti.
That's a surprise.
It was a twist. But of course, Freeling, they weren't going to take that lying down, so they appealed. And that's where our deep dive really begins. Well, for everyone listening, what we're doing today is dissecting how the appeals court, the 11th Circuit, approached this case. And more broadly, we're looking at how courts tackle these trademark disputes, especially focusing on that all-important likelihood of confusion test.
It's the cornerstone of trademark law.
For sure. And the goal here is to give everyone some key takeaways, some real-world lessons for anyone dealing with brands and intellectual property. So let's start unpacking this. First up, the Ogetti mark itself. The appeals court, they didn't see eye to eye with the first court on this. They felt Ogetti was a much stronger mark than the district court gave it credit for.
And this is where things get a little technical, but stick with me. There's this legal concept of a suggestive mark. Now, Ogetti, it's Italian for objects, and let's be honest, it doesn't scream high-end furniture.
At first glance.
Right. It kind of hints at it, suggests it, but it takes a little leap of imagination to connect the dots between the name and the product. It's not like, say, speedy delivery for a courier service that's descriptive. It just tells you what they do. A suggestive mark, like copper tone for sunscreen, it subtly suggests a benefit, a copper tone to your skin, without literally saying
Oh,
sunscreen.
I get it.
Suggestive marks, they're seen as inherently stronger, more protectable than descriptive marks. Like if you named your furniture store, that's descriptive, not very unique.
Not going to win any awards for creativity.
Right. So Ogetti, it's a bit more clever, a bit more evocative, and that makes it legally stronger. And then on top of that, you've got that federal registration and the big one, that incontestable status since 1985.
Okay, let's break down incontestable, because I think a lot of people might not fully grasp what that means for a brand, especially in the legal arena.
Incontestability, it's a huge advantage. It basically means that after 5 years of continuous use, after you register your trademark, assuming you do all the paperwork and everything's good, that mark is pretty much immune to challenges. Like, nobody can come along and say, oh, that name was just describing the product back when you registered it, or, hey, someone else was using it first, so it's not really yours. It's like a legal shield.
Shield of awesome day.
Pretty much. For Freeling, this meant that by 1985, their right to use Ogetti for their high-end furniture, legally, it was extremely solid. And the 11th Circuit, they felt that the district court didn't give this enough weight in their decision, especially when there was no evidence of other companies, you know, using similar names for the same type of furniture.
And they even made a statement about it, something like, and I'm paraphrasing here, the stronger the mark, the greater the scope of protection. That seems like a foundational concept.
It is. It's a core principle in trademark law. It means that if you have a really strong mark, a very distinctive one, you get a wider legal safety net. It's like your brand has a bigger force field around it. So anyone out there building a brand, take note. Aim for a suggestive mark, register it federally, and if you can, go for that incontestable status. It's worth it.
It's like leveling up your brand.
Exactly.
Okay, let's move on to the names themselves. Ogetti versus Bell Ogetti. The district court, they thought these were distinct enough. But the appeals court, they strongly disagreed. They really hammered home this idea that Ogetti is the central dominant element in both names. Even with Bell added, which we know means beautiful in Italian, that core Ogetti part, it just stands out.
It's like adding extra to Coca-Cola. It's still Coca-Cola.
Right. You can't hide the main thing. And legally, that's a big deal.
Oh, huge. And the way courts analyze the similarity, it's quite fascinating. They don't just glance at it and say, yeah, those look kind of similar. They break it down, how the marks look visually, how they sound phonetically, and what they mean conceptually. So visually, the shared Ogetti, it's the most prominent part of both names. Phonetically, when you say them out loud, they sound really alike, especially the emphasis on the O-J-E-T part. And conceptually, both evoke this image of objects or beautiful objects for your home.
It's a multi-sensory test.
It is. And the appeals court, they basically said the district court made a pretty big mistake in concluding those names were dissimilar. In legal terms, they called it clearly erroneous.
Not pulling any punches.
Not at all. So the takeaway here is clear. Just tacking on a descriptive word to an existing strong mark, it's probably not going to hold up legally. It's like trying to hide a lion by giving it a hat.
Good analogy.
Thanks. Now let's shift gears to the products themselves. Freeling's high-end furniture versus ISG's more, well, let's say, affordable, ready-to-assemble stuff. The district court, they really emphasized those differences. They argued that someone looking to buy luxury furniture wouldn't even consider the budget options and vice versa.
Different shoppers, different needs.
That was their logic. But the appeals court, they took a broader view. They argued that both types of furniture, even with their price differences, they both fall under the umbrella of home goods.
Okay, I see.
And consumers, they're not always experts, right? They might reasonably think that a company known for, say, very expensive fancy furniture could also have a line that's more affordable, like a brand extension. Or maybe they license their name to another company making those budget-friendly options. Like, think of designer clothing brands. A lot of them have those more affordable diffusion lines.
Yeah, it happens all the time.
Exactly. So even though the products weren't identical, the appeals court felt there was still a real possibility that consumers might think they came from the same source or were somehow connected. And here's a point for everyone listening. Consumers, they don't always have all the information. They often rely on brand names. It's like a mental shortcut to figure out quality, style, maybe even where it was made. And when names are similar, even if the products are a bit different, it can trigger that assumption of a connection, even if there isn't one.
Brand recognition is powerful.
It is. It can really influence perception. So let's talk about where these products were sold and who was buying them. The district court, they highlighted differences in the specific stores where you'd find these brands, but the appeals court, they pointed out something interesting. There was a considerable overlap in the types of places they were sold. Both companies used home furnishing stores and magazines to promote their stuff.
Same marketing channels.
Exactly. So even if Freeling's furniture was in, say, fancy boutiques and ISG's was in big box stores, they were both advertising in those general home decor magazines, reaching a similar audience. The shared exposure, it increases the likelihood of consumers seeing both brands in a similar context, which can add to the confusion.
Multiple touch points.
Right. And it's the same story with advertising. Both companies used home decor magazines, targeting a similar demographic, even with their different price points. So again, more opportunities for confusion.
More chances for those brands to get mixed up in a consumer's mind.
Precisely. Now, let's move on to a trickier aspect, ISG's intention when they picked the name Bell Ogedy. The first court, they didn't find solid evidence that ISG intentionally set out to copy Freeling. But the 11th Circuit, they saw something else, something they called intentional blindness.
Okay, hold on. Intentional blindness. That sounds like a legal thriller movie title. What does that even mean in trademark law? And why do courts view it so negatively?
It's a good question. Intentional blindness, it's not about proving that a company was like, let's go out there and trick people into thinking we're Freeling.
More subtle than that.
Right. It's more about showing that they were aware of the existing established mark, in this case, Ogedy, and they just kind of went ahead and chose a similar name without really bothering to investigate whether it might cause confusion or even getting legal advice. It's like turning a blind eye on purpose.
Risky move.
It is. And courts don't like it because it hints at bad faith that a company might be trying to benefit from the reputation of a well-known brand, even if they weren't intentionally trying to fool anyone. So the lesson here is do your research. If you're choosing a brand name, don't just ignore obvious similarities to existing brands. It can backfire.
Get that legal advice early on.
Always a good idea.
Now, what about actual cases of consumers getting confused? The district court, they didn't find much evidence of this, but the appeals court highlighted something pretty significant.
You're thinking about that professional buyer, right?
Yes, that's what I was getting at. Tell us about that.
Okay, so finding proof that people are actually getting confused, it's always strong evidence in trademark cases. But gathering that kind of evidence, it can be tough. In this case, the documented instances of actual confusion, they were admittedly minimal. But the 11th Circuit made a point that even though there was just one professional buyer in the furniture industry who got confused, that carried a lot of weight.
Why is that? Why would the confusion of one industry insider be such a big deal?
Well, think about it. Those professional buyers, those industry insiders, they generally know a lot more about brands and where they come from than the average person. They're supposed to be more discerning, more in the know. So if even they get tricked by the similarity between Ogedy and Bell Ogedy, it suggests that regular consumers who aren't as familiar with these brands, well, they're even more likely to be confused.
Makes sense. If the pros are getting tripped up.
Right. Then what chance does the average shopper have? It's a valid point.
So with all this in mind, the strength of Ogedy as a trademark, the similarity between the two names, the fact that both brands fall under the home goods category, the overlapping retail and advertising strategies, ISGs, let's say intentional blindness, and even that limited but significant evidence of professional buyer confusion, the 11th Circuit, they came to a very different conclusion than the district court.
Didn't they? It's a good example of how the appeals process works. Sometimes the higher court takes a second look and says, hang on, we see this a bit differently. And in this case, they reversed the decision of the district court.
Flip the script.
Totally. They concluded that Freeling had shown that their senior Ogedy mark was likely to be confused with ISG's Bell Ogedy mark. They basically said the lower court didn't put enough emphasis on all those factors combined.
It's the total picture, not just one piece of the puzzle.
Exactly.
All right. So for everyone listening, especially those of you deep in your law studies, what are the key analytical points here? What are the takeaways from this case that we should all burn into our memory banks?
One big lesson, and it's something we've touched on, is that cumulative effect of all the factors in that likelihood of confusion test. Courts, they're not just ticking boxes on a checklist, seeing who has more checks. They weigh each factor, see how important it is in the specific situation. Even if some factors, like maybe slightly different target markets, seem to favor the defendant, if the other factors are strong enough, like the strength of the mark, how similar the names are, and evidence of, say, intentional blindness, those can tip the scales in favor of the trademark owner. That's a judgment call.
Nuance is key.
Absolutely. And speaking of key things, the power of incontestability, that really shines through in this case. It's not just a formality, it's a major legal advantage.
Incontestables are the way to go.
If you can get it, yeah. It makes it much easier for a brand to prove infringement and makes it much harder for someone to defend themselves if they're accused of infringement. It's a big deal in trademark law, for sure.
Makes sense. And this whole idea of intentional blindness, that's another big takeaway, right? You can't just hope a similar name will slip through the cracks.
Right. You've got to be proactive. Do your due diligence. This case underscores how important it is to do your research, to really look into whether your chosen name is too close to an existing one, and to get legal advice early on. Ignoring a similar mark, even if it's not intentional copying, it can have serious legal consequences.
So the big picture here, it's not just about avoiding exact copies. It's about thinking about the overall impression a name gives and whether it might confuse consumers.
That's it. And as this case shows, even a tiny bit of evidence that actual confusion is happening, especially if it's coming from people who are professionals in that industry, that can be very convincing for a court. It's real-world proof that the potential for confusion is there.
So to sum up this deep dive, Freeling v. International Select Group is a powerful example that trademark law is about more than just matching names or identical products. It's about how consumers perceive things, how they see those brands and products in the marketplace, and preventing them from being misled.
It's about protecting both the brands and the people who buy them. And it emphasizes that you have to consider the strength of an existing mark, the possibility of confusion, even with slight similarities, and of course, the legal framework around all of this.
So, as you go about your day, think about the brands you encounter. How unique are their names? How about their logos? This case shows the importance of protecting brands and making sure consumers aren't getting confused. It's a fascinating area of law. And I'm curious, what are some brands out there that you think might be towing the line, maybe even risking a similar legal battle?
Yeah.
Something to ponder. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Freeling Enterprises v. International Select Group. We'll see you next time.